Okay, thanks. So, let's see. Is there a? Oh, there's a hockey stick. Is that? This is the pointer.
Indeed, yeah.
Good. So, what I'd like to talk about today is work that I've been doing in galactic dynamics, and in particular on the dynamics of stars in the solar neighborhood, and the question of whether we are seeing evidence for interactions of the disk of the Milky Way with satellites and dark matter substructure. Before I do, though, let me mention my collaborators in these efforts. The first paper on this was written in collaboration with Brian Yenny and Scott Dodelson at Fermilab, and Susan Gardner, who's a particle physicist from the University of Kentucky, and also a graduate student, Shenyu Chen, from the University of Chicago. There's a second paper, which is out soon in monthly notices, that I've worked on with undergraduate and graduate students at Queen's, Jared Barber, Matthew Checkers, and Ed Chang. And there are ongoing projects with other students at Queen's as well. And along the way, I'll describe some work that I've done over the years in galactic dynamics with John Dubinsky, who's at CETA. So let me begin with the three-slide version of the talk. I think everyone's familiar with the basic picture of a large spiral galaxy. We have a rapidly rotating disk of stars and gas. At the center of the galaxy is the bulge, where the orbits of the stars are on more random motions. And then all of this is embedded in a dark matter halo, composition unknown, but the structure is such that it can explain the flat rotation curves that we see. We know from N-body simulations that if dark matter is in the form of a cold dark matter particle, if it was non-relativistic during the time when structure forms, and if structure forms hierarchically, then these halos have a wealth of substructure, lots and lots of subhalos. Our disk would sit deep inside this dark matter halo, and it's natural to ask what all of this substructure would do to a disk like the disk of the Milky Way. So here's a simulation, actually an M31 model. The orange blobs interacting with this disk are meant to be a substructure of a dark matter halo, and you can see that this substructure is exciting lots of spiral structure in the disk of this galaxy. It also excites a bar. In fact, a bar wouldn't form if there wasn't substructure, at least in this particular model. What I'd like to focus on, though, in this talk, let's see if this is going to work. I think it's easier just to wait than to try and jump the slides. It's right here. We're going to go to an edge-on view of this galaxy. And what I'd like to focus on in this talk is the vertical motions of stars in the disk of this galaxy. I think you can see that as this substructure is passing through this disk, there's evidence for waves, vertical oscillations propagating through the disk of the galaxy. And so the hypothesis of this talk is that we're seeing evidence for these vertical oscillations in the galaxy, and that they're due to substructure or satellite galaxies that are passing through the disk.
How much of the dark matter
is in the substructure?
Yeah.
It's about 10%. And the simulation was designed to match what we infer for the amount of substructure in typical dark matter halos.
By the way, one of those substructures actually bounds off the.
Well, I think that may have had to do with how things were imaged, you know, and something sort of passing through, and how John actually made the movie. But there was one that passed right through the center, and I think that's the one responsible for the formation of the bar. That is, you have to have some substructure going right in that is in resonance with a bar mode that causes the bar to form in this case. And in fact, the original paper was really about bar formation.
How would you use substructure?
These substructures are on a whole variety of scales, from you know, something that could be very small to a few percent of the total mass of the dark halo.
Oh, okay. So, isn't there a limit where they actually start getting stripped, tidal stripped?
Yeah. So there's, I mean, you could see the tidal stripping in
yeah,
the simulation.
Something like this.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's there.
Yeah.
So they survive. So most of them don't survive today. So this is not assuming. So how long in the evolution of the galaxy do you think these?
How long? This is a 5 billion year simulation.
So. Oh, okay.
It's a long simulation, yeah. So here's a basic outline of the talk. I'll begin by discussing an old problem in astrophysics called the Oort problem, then describe observational evidence for perturbations in the solar neighborhood perpendicular to the galactic midplane, so these vertical oscillations, and then talk a little bit about the theory of disk-satellite interactions and vertical perturbations as an early stage of something called disk heating, the heating of the galactic disk due to the interaction with the substructure. So this talk really begins with a remarkable paper in 1932 by Jan Oort, a Dutch astronomer, who was interested in inferring the force exerted on the stars in the Milky Way perpendicular to the galactic plane. It's really perhaps the first paper that had a pretty close to correct model of the galaxy that attempted to infer the potential from the kinematics of stars. And here he talks about how a third purpose was the derivation of an accurate value of the total amount of mass, including dark matter, 1932, and he's talking about dark matter, which is quite interesting, corresponding to unit luminosity in the surroundings of the sun. So he understands that kinematics can tell you about matter that isn't visible. In fact, to be clear on the history, you can go back 10 years earlier to a paper by Kepten. Kepten's model of the Milky Way hasn't quite stood the test of time as Oort's did. But Kepten also understood this idea. It says down here, incidentally, suggested that when his theory, which wasn't quite on target as Oort, but he's 10 years earlier, is perfected, it may well be possible to determine the amount of dark matter from its gravitational effect. So as far as I know, this is the first place where people are talking about dark matter in the galaxy. And this is all before Zwicky's famous paper, 1937. I think there's an earlier paper in German in 33 on the dark matter in clusters of galaxies, where Zwicky looks at the motions of the cluster galaxies, infers the virial mass from the line of sight velocities of the cluster galaxies, compares with the luminous matter, and finds famously that the ratio is about a factor of 500. So here we have the first concrete observational evidence for dark matter on the cluster scale, not on the galaxy scale. So it's sort of a different problem, and no evidence that this was at all linked to what Oort was thinking about. And this is all 40 years before Rubin and Ford's famous paper on the rotation curve of the Andromeda galaxy, in which Rubin and Ford find this flat rotation curve, so a rotation curve that is essentially constant well beyond the visible edge of the galaxy. Here you see Rubin and Ford talking about the total mass to 24 kiloparsecs. That's about three times our distance from the galactic center, but here in Andromeda. They estimate the mass from the rotation curve and argue that it's about twice what you would get from the disk interior. And so this is here evidence for dark matter on the galactic scale, factor of 2 above what you get in the disk.
Although this is in many respects, this model resembles the model of the disk of our galaxy in the line after.
Right.
That implies that.
It's consistent in shape. Yeah. So Andromeda looks like our galaxy. I haven't dug into the paper to see what more they say about this. It actually, just for a bit more history, 10 years earlier, Vera Rubin had other observations of a flat rotation curve, non-Keplerian rotation curve, but didn't argue much of it. And that was from stellar kinematics. So, yeah, you should sort of dig in exactly what they mean by this one. So it's interesting to think about a little bit about how we infer dark matter, because I think it leads in a little bit into this talk. Typically, we measure kinematics. We measure velocities and positions, or line of sight velocities, and perhaps peculiar motions and things like that. We make some assumption about the orbits, because we only measure positions and velocities. We need the acceleration then to infer the gravitational potential. And then once we have the potential, we can estimate the density by solving Poisson's equation. That gives us the mass distribution. Then we can estimate the visible, the density of visible matter by some photometric observations, and that tells us something about the dark matter. But there's really this key assumption here that we have to make some assumptions about the orbits of the tracers of the potential that we're interested in. For the Rubin and Ford measurement, the assumption is that these H2 regions are on circular orbits, and then you apply Newton's laws in spherical or at least azimuthal symmetry. You find that the mass increases linearly. That's from Rubin's abstract, and therefore the density has to go like something like r to the minus 2. And as we'll see here, that's roughly the density profiles that we find for dark matter halos from numerical simulations, cosmological simulations. So the typical dark matter halo that you find in a cosmological simulation, again, has all of this substructure, but the spherically averaged density profile has a structure that might be more r to the minus 1 in the inner part and r to the minus 3 in the outer part, but in the bit where we're really probing flat rotation curves, it's roughly r to the minus 2. I'm plotting here r squared times rho, and so where this is flat, rho is going like r to the minus 2. The M interior is going roughly linearly, and we, again, get a flat rotation curve.
Is M where you turn around and, going to zero effect was...
The statement I remember, and maybe this isn't true, Mike might know the answer, is that we don't have a spiral galaxy where we really can see the edge, where we really know where the rotation curve is going Keplerian. Certainly not from
lensing.
Lensing might do it, yeah. Rotation curves. Yeah, rotation curves are never in the Keplerian regime, but lensing might do it. And it's interesting to note that there's this, with rotation curve fitting, there's something known as the disk halo degeneracy, which essentially says that you can trade off disk from halo, essentially because the mass to light ratio of the stars in the disk is unknown. And that leads to an uncertainty in the amount of dark matter we have in the solar neighborhood. And so there are a variety of models that can fit the same rotation curve. But here's the disk of one model, a very light disk or a very heavy disk, and corresponding heavy or light dark halo. And that leads to very different estimates for the amount of dark matter you have at, say, 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy. There's a whole industry, and obviously a lot more work has been done in the intervening 2.5 decades, but... No, it's a factor of 2 or 3, perhaps. We know a fair bit, but even then, you still have to make some assumptions about the dark halo. You know, the dark halo's density profile should be sort of monotonically decreasing and not too clumpy and so forth. But this really takes us to the Oort problem, which is the one place where we have the opportunity to actually constrain the amount of dark matter locally in the galaxy. And so the idea, Oort's idea, is that you can observe the kinematics of stars in one small patch of the galaxy centered on the sun. You can study the motions of the stars in the direction perpendicular to the galactic midplane. Assume, big assumption, but assume that you can decouple this Z dependence from variations across the plane of the disk, and use the fact from galactic dynamics that there's an approximate integral of motion, the energy associated with vertical oscillations out in and out of the galactic midplane. So this gets to something known as the epicycle approximation of galactic dynamics. If all of the mass of the galaxy were located in the center of the galaxy, then stars would be on elliptical orbits that would be closed, simple Keplerian orbits. But since the mass is distributed throughout the galaxy, the orbits are on follow these rosette patterns, so unclosed ellipses. Yep. I think in the next slide I'll get to that in a little bit more. So riding along with, say, a particle on a perfect circular orbit, you would see stars moving radially in random motion and azimuthally. and also vertically. And so the stars are executing something close to periodic motion as they go in and out of the galactic plane as they orbit around the center of the galaxy. Okay, and the epicycle approximation essentially says that if you follow the circular orbit, then the potential is almost harmonic oscillator potential, both vertically and radially. So here's essentially this question of how well is EZ conserved. This is a phase-space plot of the particle in vertical height from the midplane and vertical velocity. If EZ were perfectly conserved, then these particles would trace out a closed path in ZVZ phase space. And likewise, you can plot EZ as a function of Z. And here's the energy, which is oscillating. There's no drifting of the energy. It's not perfectly conserved. In fact, it's only conserved to sort of 10 or 20%. But it's a reasonable starting point for galactic dynamics. So it's a starting point for doing studies of this type. But it's certainly, as particles get further and further from the galactic midplane, the approximation breaks down.
Yeah.
This is a static potential, but a realistic Milky Way, static Milky Way potential. We haven't allowed the Milky Way in this case to form spiral structure and so forth. I'm simply tracing out an orbit in this three-component potential. So just a bit of collisionless dynamics, again, as background. Stars in the disk are collisionless. They move under the influence of the mean gravitational field of all the other stars in the galaxy. Essentially, one can ignore star-star encounters. And therefore, you can describe this as a phase-space distribution function, a density of stars in six-dimensional phase space of the galaxy. And then you apply Liouville's theorem and the continuity equation and derive the collisionless Boltzmann equation, which essentially says that this phase-space distribution evolves as a incompressible fluid in six dimensions. So that's ultimately the problem one's solving in galactic dynamics. Just to get a sense of what happens in this case, you can take a simple, just as an illustration, a simple Hamiltonian system, a number of particles that are going to evolve in a two-dimensional phase space according to a very simple Hamiltonian. You can see that the phase space structure winds up in a very complicated way, but by Liouville's theorem, the density of particles in phase space remains the same even as the phase space gets curled up, and that's the essence of Liouville's theorem. So in six dimensions, the collisionless Boltzmann equation becomes quite complicated. And of course, then it's coupled to gravity. That is, the force term comes from the gravitational potential, which comes from the density, which comes from the distribution function. So everything must be solved self-consistently. And at this stage, one says, let's do n-body simulations. That's the standard approach for solving these equations. If we're interested in setting up an equilibrium model, so if we assume, for example, that the galaxy is in some sort of time-independent, at least approximate, equilibrium state, then you can set the partial time derivative of f with respect to t equal to 0, and then appeal to Jean's theorem, which says that any function of the integrals of motion, such as the energy or angular momentum, is then a solution of the time-independent collisionless Boltzmann equation. And this gives you a starting point for constructing equilibrium models of things like disk galaxies. So the simplest textbook example is a distribution function that's simply the Boltzmann distribution. So stars have some energy that falls off exponentially. And that, in fact, leads to an r to the minus 2 profile, which is nice. It suggests that dark halos may be something close to an isothermal sphere. Sigma is just the velocity dispersion. So it velocity dispersion plays the role of effectively a temperature of the stars, but it's not a real thermodynamic temperature. It's just a random motion. So if you want to build disk bulge halo systems, then you need something more complicated. A time-independent disk bulge halo system might have a bulge and halo that's described as functions of the energy. But to describe the disk, you need both the angular momentum about its symmetry axis and this energy associated with vertical motions. And so this last approximate integral of motion allows one to construct things that look like galactic disks. And that, in fact, is something that Konrad Kaikin and John Dubinsky did some time ago, and then John and I have revamped the model. And so we actually have a whole set of code available to construct disk bulge halo models if people are interested in building equilibrium galaxies. Yeah.
Did you say about judicious mean?
That you have to choose the functions carefully. You it's not enough to simply write down functions of these integrals, because then you put them back in, solve Poisson's equation self-consistently. And you want functions that lead to structures that look like the three-component galaxies that we think we live in. Yeah. So it's as much art as So here's an example of if we're interested in the Oort problem, if we're going to focus on motion just in the vertical direction, then a nice starting point is a very elegant solution first written down by Spitzer in 1942, which is essentially the potential density and distribution function of a one-dimensional system, a system where all of the gravity is perpendicular. We're just treating gravity in a plane symmetric system. It's isothermal, but now only associated with this vertical energy. You have a density that falls off exponentially away from the midplane of this system, a potential that looks like the potential for an infinite plane far away, and then it's sort of a harmonic oscillator potential at the center. And it proves to be just a nice starting point for thinking about vertical structures in the galaxy. So this is a single component equilibrium isothermal system, but if you relax these assumptions, then essentially you have a prescription for probing dark matter in the disk of the galaxy. And so your goal is to find the potential or the force as a function of height above the galaxy. You can make observations to tell you what the distribution function is. You have this approximate conserved integral. You can make observations to tell you what the density is. And then you can use the Boltzmann equation and Poisson equation to essentially get at what psi and f are. And so that's essentially what the Oort problem involves, solving those equations to get the potential. Yeah.
So this might be a very naive question, but your model already sort of assumes that the force is constant as you go away from the plane. Right?
Not constant, but
well,
a function of z. The potential only when you're far away from the midplane.
Yeah.
But in the midplane, it's that
right,
structure, right? Yeah.
But isn't there a danger, therefore, that you know, within the model itself, it infers that there is dark matter because you need to keep the force constant?
So the idea here, I think, is to try to get the shape of the potential as you go from right in the midplane to 1 or 2 kiloparsecs above the midplane. This is certainly not going to tell you something 20 kiloparsecs above the midplane, because then the whole approximation of treating things in just the vertical motion breaks down. But the question here is as you go up from 0 to 1 or 1.5 kiloparsecs, do you see a potential that implies more density than what you have in stars? And I think
so. I
that,
guess in the last slide, when you show the potential, you really
right.
Talk only about the bottom of the potential.
That's right. And you know, so here's the simple zeroth order model, and then we'll find some other technique for getting the true psi and f. And you know, I should say people have been trying this sort of since, or every time new data comes along, one tries this. So in fact, the solar neighborhood is, and this is, I think, a key point, the solar neighborhood is the one place where we can really get six-dimensional phase-space information for tracer populations in astronomy. So everywhere else in astrophysics, you measure a line of sight velocity, a distance perhaps, but a distant galaxy, there's no way to get distances within the galaxy. Here you can actually get all six components of the phase space for stars near the sun. And that's the key idea. And that's a lot of information, and you could hope to use that to probe the potential nearby. So one example is the Hipparchos satellite, which was able to measure five astrometric parameters, angular coordinates, and proper motion. And then you could supplement that with radial velocities, and then you have all six components of the position and velocity of the stars. So where our project came in was to use data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. I think everyone is familiar with Sloan, one of the truly great surveys in all of astronomy, interested in part in galaxies and quasars, but for our purposes, nearly a million stars in the solar neighborhood, so at least positions and magnitudes for something like 800,000 stars in the solar neighborhood. In addition, there's a project called SEGWE, Sloan Extension for Galactic Understanding and Exploration, which provided spectra and proper motion for a subset of the Sloan stars. And so from this, we have a catalog now of 11,000 solar neighborhood stars with full 6D phase space information. So those are the tracers of the potential locally. So SEGWE then gives us the proper motion.
Okay.
The spectra gives us an estimate for the distance and also the radial velocity. We have, there's a parallax and then there's the proper motion. So you get, I think you measure both. And, I don't think you get the proper motions and the radial velocities. Yeah.
Your distances are probably making some assumption of what their luminosities are.
That's right. So Right. So distances are essentially fitting for the color magnitude diagram, position along the color magnitude diagram. Actually, maybe solar suburb is a better, because solar neighborhood, I think, really, as you say, does denote sort of the inner couple of hundred parsecs. This is going out to 2 kiloparsecs. So a bit further than, you know, really looking at the immediate solar neighborhood. Some people call it the solar suburb. So then the idea is that SEGWE gives us phase space information. Sloan with more stars can give us rho of Z, and then one can hope to infer what the potential and the force is. So that's the setup. That's the straw man. Here's our number density, again, from that sort of set of 800,000 stars. And this is the number density as a function of height above the galactic midplane. We did, a five-parameter fit to this model, which is essentially taking two of Spitzer's solutions with different scale heights and essentially fitting to N of Z. So these 1 over Cr squared forms with a small z1 for the inner thin disk and a larger z scale height for the thick disk. So we find an agreement with what's generally thought to be the structure of the Milky Way, that the Milky Way, like other spiral galaxies, has two distinct components to its disk, a thin and a thick disk. We can't. So for us, this is a fitting formula. And I know there's been some debate, and there's been some debate on this question of whether these are really distinct components. But for us, it's just a convenient fitting formula. A single component, there is an inflection point here, and that's what we're getting.
What about metallicity?
We have some information. We haven't tried to fold it into the fit and look at whether we're really... You know, we haven't tried to weigh in, I guess, on this question of whether these are really distinct components or to what extent they are. But what interested us was if you look at the residuals to this fit, then you find that there are these residuals at about the 10% level, delta rho over rho, and the residuals have an an asymmetry about the galactic midplane. That is, there seem to be fewer stars, relatively fewer stars in the north than the south at about 500 parsecs, and then it flips sign. What that means is that even if we came up with a better fitting formula, as long as you assume your fitting formula is symmetric about the midplane, which is an assumption you would make if things are in equilibrium, then you're not going to get rid of this asymmetric residual. And even if you shift relative to the galactic midplane, that doesn't help. It's a natural thing to try. That was your question. And in fact, you can fold over north minus south. You can construct this north-south asymmetry parameter, north minus south over north plus south, and then ask whether the asymmetry is the same in different color bins and cut the data in a whole variety of ways. And again, what you find is a deficit in the north at about 500 parsecs, and then it's a little bit high in the south, and then it seems to flip sign again. And so this is this hint of a wave-like structure that got us interested, a wave-like structure that seemed to be independent of color. Yeah.
So I think shifting it should count somewhat, right?
Shifting it helps, and it shifts things up and down a little bit. But no choice of midplane is going to, of position relative to the midplane is going to remove this signal. And in our paper, we show, you know, what you would get if you shifted things by considerable amount. In fact, what it is telling you is your definition of midplane has to be thought carefully, because, you know, how do you define the midplane if things are a little different north and south? So that's a good question, and I'm thinking if I should hold off, because I have a slide a little bit later which compares the Sloan, where Sloan is looking with other surveys. But Sloan is looking at a wedge at mid-galactic latitudes, and it's looking away from the center of the galaxy. In fact, I think this may help a little bit. So here is now the density as a function of position relative to the galactic center. So from 8 to about 9 kiloparsecs, so we're looking away from the galactic center. And as a function of height, you can see you're looking at sort of a wedge. Well, and this isn't even the right coordinates for thinking about how we're seeing things. But you're looking also at a wedge in terms of galactic latitude as well. So it's not simple. And the selection function isn't particularly simple. It's geometrically a little bit complicated. I think what really
So you have some ad hoc fitting formula.
Yes.
And then you say, okay, so I try to fit it, and then there are some residuals.
Yes.
So couldn't we just, okay, because this is an ad hoc fitting formula, if I had the right fitting formula, then.
Right. So I think a better fitting formula could only, if your fitting formula is symmetric about the midplane, and if you leave the midplane as a free parameter, then nothing is going to get rid of those anti-symmetric residuals. And in fact, that's really the point of this plot, because this has nothing to do with fitting formula. This is simply north minus south over north plus south. And so there's no fitting formula in this.
But if I change the midplane, this changes, doesn't
it? It changes, but the qualitative features don't change. So I can show you, there's just another panel down here which shows how things shift with.
Yeah.
One kiloparsec.
So you have a box of 1 kiloparsec.
Yes.
And then you sum over heights of 1 kiloparsec this way, 1 kiloparsec down.
We're going 1 kiloparsec out in radius.
Yeah.
And then we're slicing in Z. That's right. So it's tricky, you know, but you take what you get in terms of the data.
But then how do you have complete asymmetry? Because your sample, I mean, how do you know this one cube is not?
So we work very hard on things like selection functions and the geometry of the selection function. There's actually a follow-up paper that I wasn't involved in, but Brian Yanni and Susan Gardner wrote, in which they really tried to look at all these questions and the geometry and so forth. And they couldn't get rid of the effect through just selection function. But let me, I think the velocities actually in some ways is more secure, so less susceptible to these types of issues. But yeah.
So you're picking one direction basically to do your sampling in here, and you're finding residual ability to fit that one direction.
That's right.
But you've got two orthogonal directions. Have you done equivalent bits in those orthogonal
directions? Yeah, so I think the right direction. So this is an attempt to go in the second direction, one of those directions, where we're now just plotting north minus south, so trying to avoid fitting functions, and you're just plotting what you measure in the north minus what you measure in the south as a function of both height and distance out from the galactic center. And then this is the region where you're low in the north, high in the south, and then another band where you're, so they seem to be bands. There seems to be, you know, no evidence for real structure in the plane.
But those are two wedges that we've differenced, right?
The two wedges that we've differenced. Yeah, that's right. So there's two, right.
There's a counterpart.
There's a counterpart in the south, and then we've taken the difference of the two.
So the question is whether you do that same algorithm but going off in different directions.
Right.
Are you going to see similar kind of behavior?
And I think in the Gardner and Yanni paper, they tried to look in some of those directions. I don't think we've seen any real structure. In the velocity fields, you actually see some structure as you go out in different directions in the plane of the galaxy. So, which I'll get to. Yeah, so the velocities also sort of surprised us. This is the bulk velocity. And in some sense, that avoids many of these issues of selection functions, because there you're just measuring stars in a given location in the galaxy and measuring their mean velocity. And so if you happen to pick more stars in one place than you thought you were picking because of selection functions, and that doesn't enter. You're taking an average of average V over total number of stars. And what we found is that the stars south were moving away from the midplane, and the stars north were moving away from the midplane. That is, there's an evidence of something like a breathing mode in the bulk velocities of the star. So V, average VZ versus height above or below the midplane, here you're a little below zero velocity, here you're a little above, and so it has the sense of a breathing mode perturbation. And this is simply a cut of the data into two different color bins, trying to see if there was some effect on color. Actually, we think now there might be hints of some color dependence, but which perhaps could be explained physically.
So is that concerning because you saw multiple wavelengths in the density?
Yeah. I think velocities, and so this perturbation, in fact, wouldn't show up in the density. So they're really probing different things. A breathing mode perturbation would be symmetric about the midplane. Now, I don't think we have, since the velocities came from the Segway data where we had 11,000 stars, we're not going to pick up perhaps higher order modes. But I think velocities and densities are giving you perhaps complementary information. So just a bit more on this, you know, going back to the history in this paper, remarkable again, paper by Oort, where he actually looked for this effect, realizing that he didn't see any evidence for these bulk motions, but he argues that the results, no bulk motion, are entirely satisfactory, as they show no systematic motions in the direction perpendicular to the galactic midplane. This leads to the assumption stated in the first section that in the Z direction, the stars are thoroughly mixed. And so he's arguing that the absence of bulk motion is evidence that things are in rough equilibrium. And here we're finding evidence for bulk motions. And so perhaps we should take a break from the Oort problem and figure out what these bulk motions are due to. That's essentially the idea. Since that time, Mary Williams, working with the RAVE collaboration, Radial Velocity Experiment collaboration, were able to also measure bulk motion. So they did try to look at the bulk motions in position relative to the galactic center and height above the midplane. And they find evidence for, again, something like breathing or compression in rarefaction modes. And so here you have stuff moving away from the galactic midplane inside the position of the sun and stuff moving toward the galactic midplane outside the position of the sun. So perhaps you're seeing some oscillation in the bulk motion of stars near the sun.
This doesn't look like the one that you showed before.
That's right. So let me, and this will get back to the other question, which is where Sloan is looking. And as well, Jeff Carlin and Heidi Newberg and company using the LMOST telescope, a new telescope in China, looked for this as well, and they see evidence for, let's see, so here the velocities are actually high toward the midplane in both north and south, so they're seeing something with the opposite sign. So it's confusing, and just to maybe add to the confusion or show you that it should be confusing, this was something that Jeff Carlin put together in their paper, essentially showing you where the footprint of the three different surveys are. And I don't think I can go through this in any great detail, but these are different projections and different galactic coordinates. So this is looking away from the galactic center. So here the galactic center would be over here. And the different color contours correspond to the different surveys, and everyone's looking in different places in the galaxy. So I don't want to try to make sense, too much sense of this, but realize that everyone has a different footprint on the solar neighborhood. And everyone's waiting for the Gaia telescope, so that's where this is heading. So one possibility is that the features that we're seeing in the number counts and bulk velocities arise from some stream of stars mixing in with stars in the solar neighborhood. So we know there are lots of streams. There's a Sagittarius stream, famous bifurcation of the Sagittarius stream. There's a stream here called the Orphan stream. There's the Manassas ring or Manassas string. PAL 5, I think, is down here. So there's all sorts of stuff going on in the stars, in halo stars, that can mix in with the solar neighborhood.
So what are the circles there?
The circles. Virgo over density. That's a good question. I'm not sure what those circles are. They look, yeah, they look like globular clusters, perhaps. They're all enclosing some objects.
Sorry.
That's right. So we wanted to ask a different, or probe a different hypothesis, which is whether the north-south asymmetry that we're seeing is actually a perturbation intrinsic to the disk, prompted by a passing satellite or dark matter subhalo. Something comes through the galaxy and causes oscillations and coherent motions similar to what we saw at the very beginning simulation that I showed. And I think this wave-like structure, the fact that it seemed to be roughly color independent, the bulk motion suggested that maybe we were seeing something coherent in the disk rather than just some stream of stars mixing in. And so again, this idea that the halos of typical galaxies such as the Milky Way have lots of substructure, there are lots of things that can pass through the disk and prompt some perturbation in the disk. Well, this simulation is meant to show that even if you start with a perfectly axisymmetric disk, then the random positions of the initial particle distribution is actually enough to excite spiral structure and bars, essentially because the disk is unstable. And so instabilities in at least some models for disk galaxies can lead to something dramatic like the formation of a bar or spiral structure.
Is that a problem, given the fact that we see non-bar galaxies?
What it says, and actually this goes back to the first, I believe the first suggestion for dark matter halos is that you can't make disks too heavy. That is, it gives you a constraint on how much of gravity in the disk is self-gravity and how much comes from something else, the bulge or the halo. And it was Ostreicher and Peebles who said if you embed disks in dark halos, then you can prevent rapid bar formation and stabilize disks. And that was one of the first arguments for dark halos. So you could think a little bit about where these instabilities come from. Any self-gravitating system, perturbations will grow if gravity dominates over pressure. By here we mean that not pressure in a hydrodynamic sense, but pressure in the random motion of stars. And essentially this gets to the idea of a Jeans length, that perturbations on scales larger than the Jeans length will grow. Perturbations on smaller scales, perturbations on larger scales will grow. Perturbations on smaller scales will oscillate. And you can calculate the Jeans length for roughly associated with vertical motions in the disk of the galaxy and find that essentially you expect the galaxy to be stable against gravitational collapse vertically. And I think that sort of comes all the way back to the Spitzer solution, that if you hit a disk, it can oscillate in the vertical direction, but you're not going to form clumps vertically. It's not going to stratify vertically. These instabilities, though, are precisely what lead to things like spiral structure and bars. It's, in a sense, a type of Jeans instability. So this, again, is this simulation that that John Dubinsky and a graduate student of his, J.R. Gauthier, and I did. We were interested in the formation of bars. This was a model of M31 in which a bar would not form if the halo were smooth, but when the halo is made clumpy, then one of the substructure actually excites a bar formation. Yep. Where you might see these instabilities. I think how perturbations evolve in the vertical direction is actually, there's been relatively little work done on this. And so while the problem of how bars form and spiral structure forms has been studied, you know, by sort of countless theorists, what happens in the vertical direction and how if you perturb, say, the Spitzer solution, how those perturbations evolve, I think is still somewhat of an open question. And in fact, sort of precisely where the talk is going. So you're kind of anticipating where we're heading. But, that essentially we want to understand in the same way that we've tried to understand how spiral structure evolves and how bars form, we'd like to understand what happens vertically to the structure of the galaxy, especially now that we have all this data on phase-space structure. So here, in fact, is this simulation, just a snapshot of the simulation. So this is a face-on view with all of this substructure. You can see the tidal streams coming from the substructure, as well as spiral structure in the disk that was prompted or excited by the substructure. This is the vertical, looking at it edge-on. And here's taking a little snapshot of an area, something similar to the solar neighborhood, and looking at the density asymmetry parameter and the bulk velocities. And you know, maybe there are hints of sort of structures that, I don't know, you have to squint a little bit, that look a little bit like what we see in the data. Yeah?
Yeah, so what assumption are you making for these chunks that are hitting the disk? Because if they come from all possible directions,
that's right. So the assumptions are that it has a subhalo mass function, a spectrum in terms of mass, given by any of the number of studies on subhalos in hierarchical clustering. So people like Ben Moore and Gao and so forth have quantified the subhalo mass function, the amount of substructure and the spectrum in terms of mass. Then we put them, that tells you what the mass spectrum is, and then you put them on essentially random orbits similar to the orbits of halo particles, start the system off and just ask what happens. And at the time that we did the simulation, we were interested in both what would happen at the disk and then how this substructure survives. So what fraction of the mass in subhalo is still in subhalos at the end of 5 billion years, those sorts of questions. Yeah.
So, so how much does this depend on the model for the subhalo mass function? Like, is a motion of perturbation being caused by subhalos with a particular mass? Are you more dependent on the heavier subhalos or the lighter subhalos?
So in terms of bar formation, I know that we actually did sort of 10 versions of this simulation. And in fact, in 5 of them, you form bars, and in 5, you don't. And the bar formation time was model dependent, or dependent, stochastic dependent, you know, dependent on the initial conditions of the subhalos. In other words, it's a random process. And the fact that one of these subhalos came into the inner galaxy, got into the inner galaxy, had, I think, an orbit that must have been matched with a bar mode, excited the bar. And in other cases, you don't get a subhalo that goes in and excites the bar. So I think that's hit or miss. In terms of the vertical structure, we just haven't really studied this carefully enough. And a point I would make here is that the resolution really isn't there yet. We're trying to do solar neighborhood physics, where the data is one solar mass resolution, in a simulation where the resolution is 1,000 solar masses. You know, every particle is 1,000, you know. So we need, actually, we need much better resolution to really get at what's happening on the 100 parsec scale.
Those different panels, different times?
These panels are different positions within the data. So taking a 1 kiloparsec and looking around a ring for things that might look like the data. And it's not clear how successful we are. We haven't gone back to do that. I think with the bar formation, you know, you can kind of see one guy go through and do something. We've gone back actually and just looked at single satellites going through, and I'll show you that. You can see things like breathing and bending mode. So. A snapshot toward the end of the simulation, but just to show again, and this is all meant to be very preliminary, but to show that if you look in a region, so this is a region from 6 to 10 kiloparsecs from the galactic center in this model, looking at high bulk velocity or low bulk velocity, you can see regions that look a little bit like the data, where you get change from compression to rarefaction. So there might be something there, but this is really a very preliminary sort of result. So just a kind of a quick overview. You might think of the properties of the solar neighborhood. We're about 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy. The vertical motions have a range of about 10 to 40 kilometers per second. We're moving about the galactic center at about 230 kilometers per second. And the surface density in the region of the solar neighborhood is about 5, 10 to the 7 solar masses per kiloparsec squared. And so you could imagine that a satellite with comparable surface density, so I think that's kind of one of the relevant quantities, that surface density is proportional to the force, in sync with the rotation, so you want something that's perhaps matched with the rotation to get the maximum effect. And in resonance with the vertical motions will produce strong perturbations. And in fact, there's a nice paper by Purcell and James Bullock and company in which they argue that Sagittarius could be the architect of the Milky Way spiral structure. And a paper in Nature, in fact, in which they simulate Sagittarius going through the disk and then show that the spiral structure that develops looks actually qualitatively similar to what we see in our galaxy. And then went back and looked in their simulations and found vertical waves induced by this Sagittarius model that were similar to what we saw in the data. So essentially anyone who's had done a simulation of satellites heating a disk can go back and look for these vertical modes and see what, if they have the resolution, what they find. So a little bit on the physics. You can imagine the excitation of a vertical mode as simply a transfer of energy from the satellite. Oh, yeah.
Then that goes pretty badly for any kind of interpretation of this
Well, I think satellite galaxies must form, and I mean, it's a question of whether it's, I sort of lumped dark matter subhalos and satellites together, in that there are things with masses of 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9 solar masses compact enough to do something to the disk. Whether they happen to have stars in them or whether it's pure dark matter, in a sense, we don't care. Maybe the stuff with stars is more, has more something more compact, which is probably important for the perturbation. Their model, so they're only doing Sagittarius, and I'm trying to remember, their Sagittarius was fairly heavy, like a 10 to the 9 solar mass Sagittarius, if I'm remembering correctly. So I think it was their heavy, they did two, a light Sagittarius and a heavy Sagittarius. The heavy Sagittarius was able to excite the spiral structure. So you could think a little bit about the physics of this. Something moving through the disk will cause stars to essentially fall in gravitationally. This is essentially Chandrasekhar's old argument for dynamical friction. And you could imagine that as this object plunges through, it's going to excite a bending mode in the disk of the galaxy. So to try to understand a little bit better how the physics of this works, let's imagine a star that has executing periodic motion up and down through the midplane of the galaxy. So here's its position as a function of time and velocity as a function of time. Here's the satellite that's coming through with a speed that's greater than the maximum speed of the star. So this is a fast-moving satellite relative to the motion of the star. You can calculate the force, or think of it as the tidal force, of the on the satellite due to the satellite on the star, so the force relative to the midplane, and then you could calculate the change in energy of the star just by integrating up. Okay. So. This is a sort of a toy model calculation. So in a sense, the mass is. The units here are, in a sense, arbitrary. I simply want to see sort of what the shape of the curve is. And in fact, the key idea is that if I then look at a star that's exactly 180 degrees out of phase, then the force is in the opposite direction, but the energy transfers in the same sense because the velocity is going in the opposite direction. So V dot F has the same sign. And so in this case, stars on opposite sides of the distribution. So this is, again, the phase-based distribution function. Here's an equilibrium distribution, energy going radially outward. Stars would orbit in phase space clockwise. And you find that stars on opposite side of the distribution function both gain energy. And so this is the excitation of a breathing mode perturbation. So and then this phase space, perturbed phase space would then rotate with time. And so if you imagine, again, that perturbed phase space rotating with time, so here's the perturbation of the phase space where you have more particles at high velocity and fewer particles at low velocity, then that could explain the bulk velocity curve. Okay. And so if you take that phase space perturbation of the breathing mode rotated by 45 degrees, then you get a net high bulk velocity in the north and low bulk velocity in the south. So that's potentially the explanation for what's going on there. On the other hand, if you took a satellite that comes through at a slow velocity relative to the maximum speed of the star, then two stars 180 degrees apart would either gain or lose energy. And so in this case, you end up with a bending mode perturbation. So things that go slowly through the disk excite a bending mode. Things that go fast through the disk excite a breathing mode. And perhaps higher order modes as well. So this is, if you look at a distribution of stars in energy and their phase angle, then you find that the stars that are sort of deep inside the close to the galactic midplane would have a bending mode, a breathing mode perturbation. So you see this positive perturbation, negative, positive, negative perturbation. So that's the breathing mode. And the stars at sort of the edge and energy of the distribution would have more of a bending mode perturbation. So it's telling you that stars of different energy would experience different types of perturbations. And then the question is, how do these things evolve with time? But just this general picture then that we could begin to think of a mode type analysis of perturbations. So imagine you take the density and simply shift it away from the midplane, then think of that as an M equals zero type mode, a midplane displacement. That's one type of perturbation that could occur in the galaxy, and in fact, something seen in the interstellar medium. The next higher order perturbation would be a breathing mode. So stars on above and below the galactic midplane are both pushed either toward or away from the midplane. So that could explain what you see in the velocity field. And then you could imagine some higher order perturbation, which perhaps explains what's going on in the number density, the number counts as a function of height above the midplane. One of the fun things that we can play with is n-body dynamics in one dimension. It's fun because you can write the n-body code very quickly. The force acting on any particle is just the number of particles above minus the number of particles below. And there are some nice examples in the very old cosmology literature of people studying the collapse of one-dimensional systems back in the day when neutrinos were a viable, or hot neutrinos were a viable dark matter candidate, and computers were not as powerful as they are today. And so you can, for example, begin with the Spitzer solution and perturb it and ask what happens as a function of time. And so here again is this EZ versus theta phase space structure. We took a Spitzer solution, perturbed it with some passing satellite, excited something like a bending mode. As time evolves, this bending mode gets phase mixed, and perhaps there's other effects like Landau damping which occur. But you get long-lived structures, especially at the edge and energy of the distribution function. So one can excite modes, and then these modes can actually persist for a long time. So here, getting to three dimensions, here's an example, preliminary results of a simulation that we've done with a Milky Way-type galaxy. So this is the disk of the Milky Way. This is a satellite that's coming through. This is a very heavy satellite. It's really doing some damage to this disk. So this probably isn't a realistic model, but it's meant to illustrate the excitation of both bending and breathing modes. And so the disk comes in and excites bending mode, so displacements of the galaxy from the midplane, but also breathing mode. So we can pick out as the satellite comes through, you can pick out places where you get a breathing mode type perturbation. And so this is a satellite comes through and you get some alternating inward and outward breathing mode, compression and rarefaction breathing mode perturbations. And so the question is what would happen in a more realistic model with lots of substructure and a proper spectrum of subhalos and so forth. Okay, so let me then give a summary. There seems to be observational evidence now from three different surveys for vertical perturbations in the kinematics of solar neighborhood stars. The galactic dynamics community is now getting geared up for data from the Gaia satellite, successfully launched in December. This should give us precision astrometric data for hundreds of millions of stars in the solar neighborhood and beyond. So really exciting, and lots of people are thinking of interesting things to do with what should be people called it a tidal wave of data. Simulations can allow us to model the observed perturbations and potentially constrain galactic substructure. So I think exploring what happens with a single perturber is one avenue, and then redoing these types of simulations where you have a whole spectrum of substructure and then perhaps constraining what that spectrum is by what we see in the bulk motions of stars. But note that at present, the simulations have not achieved the resolution of the data. This is really a place where you need to do a simulation with, say, a billion particles in the disk to really study all of the different modes and how the modes couple, both to how there's mode-mode coupling and also coupling between individual stars in these coherent motions. And I think perhaps most interestingly, this is an area where I think there are nice theoretical projects that could be done. Vertical perturbations may represent the early stages of disk heating and thickening events. One is generating and following the evolution of waves. The physics is interesting. It's the resonant excitation of perturbations, coherent oscillations, perhaps physics of Landau damping and phase mixing. Something that there's actually just a very few papers in the literature. If you compare this with the number of papers that have studied the formation of bars and spiral structure, which is certainly in the hundreds, and here there are only a handful of papers that have studied the vertical structure in any great detail. But there are all sorts of interesting effects that one can consider. Okay, I think with that I will stop.
Showed the different results from the other surveys as well as your study of Segway. It seems to, as they flash by, at least to my eyes, not to present a coherent picture. Is there a one simple model which describes all of them, or is it more likely that it's going to be quite complicated, like in the simulations where all these different modes and different surveys probing different scales and different patches of the sky?
Well, one is just making sense of it and trying to map out the bulk flows. And I think that's a project that's just out there. Try to, you know, if someone can get a hold of all of the different data sets, understand where they're all looking, and try to model what's going on. It's tricky because you actually want to model, and this gets to the question of the other directions. You really do want to simultaneously model the motion, the vertical motion, the motion in the radial and azimuthal directions, because the error matrix is not diagonal in Z, R, and phi. It's diagonal in proper motion, distance. You know, so the distance errors are proper motion errors, the radial velocity, So to properly propagate all of those errors through. Well, I think even just the problem of mapping the bulk velocity field seems itself to be a reasonable question. I mean, it's not too different from what was going on bulk velocities, but you're trying to infer the bulk velocity field from noisy, incomplete data with selection functions. So in that sense, it's not that different.
Questions? So, let me just ask you one question. So, what do you think is the end game here? So, are we going to get, so that's a bit Gaia. So, what do you think is going to happen? So, we're going to get much better velocities.
We'll have better velocities, we'll have more complete coverage.
It's not that there's going to be a simple model to fit,
there's not going to be a simple, so it may be phenomenological, and I guess there's a question of whether will one learn more about galactic dynamics or about the stuff that's perturbing the galaxy. So, both of those are going to fold in. What the galaxy does depends on galactic dynamics and the structure of the disk and all of these other phase mixing and so forth effects, but then you know, they're the perturbers. And it's still unclear to me whether one will learn as much about the perturbers or about the galactic dynamics, or a little of both.
But I guess my concern is a little bit more practical, is that you're going to get some mess.
Yes.
And for simulations, also give some messy.
Yes.
So how are you going to compare the two?
Right, it's messy work. And I think, you know, and more broadly, you know, Gaia, there's a whole community, the whole Gaia community, and even the interest in the streams as well, and how you pick out streams and how you use that stream information to constrain the potential, or something like this. I don't know, I think it's a big question. You know, you people who work on this say we still aren't exactly clear how we're going to manage the Gaia. You know, this is a case, I think, where the observations will outpace the theory, is my sense. But it's, you know, you're right, it's a big data problem. So, and the simulations also produce big data.